We have fellows of the Royal Society, IPCC lead authors on this declaration as well, which is noteworthy because they have been advising policymakers for 30 years. Nobody is reading their reports, and we scientists, for example, are actually amplifying all of those messages. So it's my distinct pleasure to introduce you to two of my colleagues for a science FAQ session. I will be going around with the microphone in a minute and taking questions, but firstly I'd like to introduce us personally. My name is Sven. I've been researching at 4 universities on 4 continents, among which the United Nations mandated University for Peace, and my specific focus is climate change adaptation, mitigation and capacity building. And I will pass you now to my first colleague Svart Archer, who will introduce himself.
I'm Dr. Scott Archer-Nichols. I am a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Cambridge, and I work on atmospheric models, so the big computer models that we use to predict how climate is going to change into the future. I develop those and I try and hopefully make our predictions a bit better. I work in the chemistry department, so the specific area I work in is what's called composition climate feedbacks. So that is how the tiny fraction of less than 1% of the atmosphere that's not oxygen or nitrogen, how the chemical reactions of those species affect climate and air pollution over time. And yeah, I'll pass over to Alan.
Thanks, Scott.
Hello, Rebels. So, my name's Aaron. I'm an ecologist by training. I've worked up in the Arctic looking at the effects that climate change has up in the Arctic on the permafrost, and what I found up there really scared me. So I'm now here on the streets with you guys taking action to try and fight for our futures, because we really need to change things really quickly, and I think all the science clear on that, and that's why we are here today, to show our support and to take part in these protests, because as Scientists for Extinction Rebellion, we recognise that we are people too, and we have the same stake in this. We're not just brains in vats. We're here caring about the future, caring about the world, caring about our families, caring about all the species that we love to study, that excite us about the natural world, and we're here to fight for them as well. So thank you, and we'd love to hear your questions and help you understand what's happening with the planetary emergency and why it is like, it's so important that we need to act. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much, you two colleagues, for your introduction. And we are all experts. And honestly, if I wasn't part of this, I would come here just to ask them questions as well, because you not often get the chance to ask such esteemed researchers, because mostly we are in our ivory towers, we're all silent people, we don't like to do this, we're very sorry for it, but unfortunately it's the only way to get us heard. And now you have the chance to ask some questions, and if you want you can just raise your hand and I will come to you and you can ask your question.
Hi, I was just wondering whether you had opinion on whether net zero is actually sufficient to stop runaway climate change, because currently we have 416 parts per million carbon dioxide, and I've heard from some sources that actually currently our levels are already too high to stop. So do you believe in any sort of carbon sequestration techniques in order to save this, or do you think that net zero is actually enough?
Okay, start with the tough questions, eh? Okay, so there's a bit to unpack there. So firstly, why is it we need to get to net zero? I'll start there. So. What we can say very clearly is that the amount of CO2 that we put out into the atmosphere, and CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and so as that is accumulating in our atmosphere, that causes the temperature of the planet to rise. And those two things have been known to be related to each other for over 150 years, okay? So we've known this for a really long time. But what we can say is that the two things are really related to each other. So the more CO2 we put out, the higher the temperature is going to get. And because of that, we can actually calculate a budget. We can say, if we want to stay below any given temperature, we have only so much CO2 we can emit before we start exceeding that. So that gives us a carbon budget. And we can't burn more than that carbon budget if we are to stay within our carbon targets. And so when the UN and all the world's nations got together a few years ago at Paris and they said we have to keep temperatures below 2 degrees and aim to keep them below 1.5 degrees Celsius, because that's when the impacts become really significant, we have to keep those below that level. So that gives us then a budget. We have only that much we can spend if we're to stay within that temperature target. And it's really small now, because we've been not taking action for 30 years. When the scientists first warned that, there was a lot of time we could have gradually responded to it, we could have stayed within that budget. But the fact is, CO2 emissions globally are still going up each year. We have not taken action on this problem, and so, as a globe, and as a consequence of that, the budget that we have left is tiny, which is why we have to get to zero as soon as possible. Does that make sense, everybody? Cool, okay. So, to get to zero, we then have to start trying to divide that budget up between different nations. How much is each country going to do to reduce emissions? Now, there's lots of different ways we could divide that up, but I think at least you could agree that it would be only fair that we do it on a per capita basis, that no one country should have more than any other. That's a potential starting point for that conversation. The UK uses more than twice the global average. So if we're going to get to zero within our carbon budget, we have to get even sooner than the average for the globe, else we overspend that budget. And so what that means is that we have to get to zero really quickly, and it is quicker than 2050. We have to get to zero much sooner than that, and that is why Extinction Rebellion is saying we have to get to zero by 2025 if we're to do our fair share of staying within this carbon budget. So that's an incredibly rapid transformation of our society. But in response to your question, there are things that we can do to also draw down CO2 from the atmosphere. And that is within the toolkit of the solutions that we have to help to get to zero. Or maybe even, like you said, get below zero and actually start taking CO2 out the air. And so that is part of the solutions that we might choose to use. But as I said, Extinction Rebellion is not here to say what are the solutions we need, it's here to open up the conversation and say there is a crisis, we have to get to zero emissions as soon as possible. How does our society think that we can do that? And we need to have that conversation in our politics, in the halls of Parliament, but also a citizens' assembly to convene people from across the UK, from all backgrounds, to discuss that and find out what solutions they say are acceptable to them and a just transformation of our society. The last part of your question was runaway warming. No, runaway warming, I think, is perhaps a misnomer. And I think we need to be clear that the science does not say that we have no control over the situation at the moment. What it says is that in our models, there are feedbacks. And these feedbacks could cause global warming to get more and more based on the... I'll start that a bit again. So there's these feedbacks. Now these feedbacks, so as we cause warming, that causes parts of the Earth system to respond to that warming. And those feedbacks will then add additional warming to the climate. Now, at the moment, as far as we know, those feedbacks will not lead to us going beyond that 1.5 degrees if we get to zero emissions before then. But the more we go over that 1.5 degrees, the more chance there are that these feedbacks will start kicking in larger and larger amounts. And that's part of the reason why those targets were agreed globally at those levels, is to stay below these tipping points, to stay below these feedbacks. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay, cool. I'm going to let the next question.
Thank you very much for your comprehensive answer. We have a question. I saw a question over there first, I think. Wonderful. I'm going to go.
Thanks very much. I would like to ask, this question might have a sort of a political and scientific response, but so from a scientific point of view, how much is carbon capture technology useful and viable? Is it a helpful stepping stone away from the fossil fuel economy, or is it actually detracting from infrastructure contributing towards an economy based on renewables and actually perpetuating the fossil fuel industry but just mitigating its negative effects in an ultimately unsustainable way?
So we got another question on carbon capture. For those of you who have never heard the term before, it basically refers to strategies of removing carbon out of the air and storing it. We've got a wonderful tool that does it already for us. It's called a tree. But however, so there are also other techniques where this gentleman is asking about. So I will pass this question, for example, up to Scott.
Hiya. Another tricky question there. So there are various ideas about how we can draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And Sven was just talking about probably one of the ones we have most proof, which is growing more trees and also restoring more natural ecosystems. And I think from the point of view of a group like Extinction Rebellion, those kind of changes make a lot of sense because it also can help with biodiversity crisis that we're facing as well. So there's another element of it, which is what are called BECCS, so biomass, energy, and carbon capture and storage. And so this is an idea of that we can grow mainly trees, very fast growing, such as pine forests, turning them into wood chip, burning them in stations, a bit like how we have coal-fired power stations now, using that to generate energy, and then burying the carbon that comes from that underground. And if you think about that, that is drawing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, storing it in the trees, and then burying it in the ground. And it can also, in theory, generate electricity at the same time, which is all well and good. The only problem is that it has never been proven to work on a large scale. So you're relying on a technology which doesn't currently exist to become invented and to be implemented on a large scale that is economically viable, that it can draw down huge quantities of carbon dioxide. Now, these ideas of using BECCS are built into a lot of the emissions pathways that are used by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, to make predictions in the future, and the UN in order to work out our budgets. And in ways, these can be used as a way of trying to delay action from now. So you're saying that in the future, we may be able to have people will be able to build these kind of technologies to clean up about what's going on now. And a lot of these scenarios will see orders of around a billion tons of carbon dioxide, 10 billion per year, which is on a similar magnitude to the amount that we are emitting now, maybe a significant fraction of that. And we really don't know whether or not that is going to be physically possible. And so I'm not necessarily against developing or working out technologies for carbon capture and storage, because I think it's going to be incredibly difficult to reduce the amount of emissions that we have in time, and we do need to have techniques of drawing it out of the atmosphere as well as reducing emissions. But I'm quite worried that it can be used as a way of delaying action. And I mean, that's probably about most of it.
Just to add one extra thing there, I think is really important to just bear in mind, okay? So what's happening in these scenarios, as Scott just said, is that we're effectively creating we're saying that there's going to be this technology in the future that doesn't currently exist, deployed on a massive scale, and if it doesn't work, then we're going to get all the climate change we say we want to avoid, okay? And so what we're basically doing here in these scenarios is gambling on the future of our kids. Because if they don't have a solution available to them at that time, and we haven't taken action now, they'll be left with this problem that is insolvable. So it's a huge gamble that we're taking on here. It's a moral, ethical question about what we're prepared to do. Are we really willing to put this responsibility onto future generations again, or are we going to act now? The other thing is, as Scott said, this is a vast amount of CO2 that we're talking about taking out in the atmosphere, and it means there's a vast scale of plantations that they're talking about. Now the question is, where are those plantations going to be? Because once you start planting all of those trees, they're going to start competing for land with other things that we also need to do, such as growing food. And so if we're in a climate which we already know is getting disrupted, and food supplies are going to be under strain, and agricultural systems are going to be under strain, we're not going to want to take that much of that land out of productive capacity in order to just start planting huge amounts of trees to burn. So there's this conflict then between energy and food that is going to be linked together if we go down these pathways. And it will be the poorest in the society, poorest in the world, that are going to be most affected by that. So again, moral choices are being put into these models, into these scenarios, and that's what governments are using to delay action.